Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. This is Steve Woodward. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning show, heard exclusively here on WEEB. Once again, I am without my regular co-host, David Hensley, who is out racking up frequent flyer miles and changing the world. But we expect he'll find his way back here to this studio before too much longer. But I am delighted to tell you that we are brought to you by our beloved sponsor, The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980. Your go-to and my go-to for breakfast, lunch, and all of your catering requirements, from small office meetings to full-scale weddings. And boy, are there a lot of those going on. Also, a reminder that coming up later in the program, we will hear from the chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans, Emily Stack, and also from a gentleman named Benjamin Rollins, who is leading the charge to establish a chapter of Turning Point USA on the campus of Sand Hills Community College. Of course, Turning Point USA, the campus outreach organization founded by our fallen brother Charlie Kirk, and spreading across the fruited plain, as Rush would say. We begin, as always, by identifying our weekly public enemy number one. This week, it's a group of people, as opposed to a single individual. And boy, are these some crazy people! These people, I will describe as the members of the Luigi Mangione fan club. You will recall Luigi Mangione is the 27-year-old who gunned down United Healthcare executive Brian Thompson last year, right before Christmas, just shot him dead on the streets of Manhattan as he walked to a hotel and a waiting conference. Mangione is now behind bars, but guess what? He's got a $40,000 fund that he can tap into for spending on commissary food and beverage items while he's imprisoned. And why? Because you've got these adoring fans of his, and I'm not making this up, sending money into his commissary account at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. A jailhouse source tells TMZ that Mangione and other prisoners can spend up to $160 at the commissary per day on snacks and creature comforts, like, oh, I don't know, Nutella, breakfast, snacks, all manner of tasty delights. And he's got $40,000 just kind of accruing to spend as he see fits. The only thing that would make this more obscene to me is if the money was earning interest, which I certainly hope it is not. Anyway, we are now waiting to see what happens to Luigi, but of course, there is video evidence that he gunned down this innocent man on the streets of New York City. So his fans are public enemies number one this week. And now, of course, we segue to our new category, public embarrassment number one. I'll tell you who the runner-up was for public embarrassment number one. It's this Delta Airlines captain who threw a senior age gentleman off of a flight because he was wearing a hat that had the word that we use to describe somebody's rear end, which starts with an A and is often used to describe a donkey as well. Build back better, my beep. And this guy was told to remove the hat because it was offensive. Now, if you've seen what people wear on airplanes these days, I would dare say that a hat that contains a mildly vulgar word is anything but offensive. And yet, this is what you get with these woke airlines now. The captain said that because the man refused to comply with the request of the flight attendant to remove the hat, they couldn't take the chance that he would be equally disobedient once the plane was in the air if he was asked to do something else by a flight attendant, like, you know, put on a seatbelt or whatever he might be doing that they deemed to be inappropriate. So there you have it. That's public embarrassment number one runner-up. But the runaway winner in the category this week is the left and their soldiers in the media who are falling over themselves to convince us that all these elements that make up Antifa, these rioters, these violent individuals in the streets, that they don't really exist as a coordinated entity, that Antifa is not really a thing. And as an example of what they're saying, listen to this very clever montage. Play clip one.
There's no Antifa. This is an entirely imaginary organization. There is not an Antifa.
Like, I don't even know what Antifa is. Group. There is no group.
It's not even like far-right groups like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. Compared to right-wing extremists, Antifa-linked violence is rare and limited.
It isn't an organization. It is, in many ways, mythology.
It's not like the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, you know, sort of defined terrorist organizations with leadership that leads violence.
It's not a highly organized movement. It's a moniker. It's not a unified group like the Proud Boys are.
Things like Antifa are things that are thought up.
It's all in this guise of going after Antifa, which is nothing. There's no organization called Antifa.
Nobody's a member of Antifa because it doesn't exist. They are just declaring into existence something that doesn't exist.
There is no Antifa organization, so maybe that's good for social media. But it really is non-existent.
They exist on the internet in chat rooms and in 4chan and Discord and places like that where they run discussion boards, trade tactics, documents, things like that. But none of them are called Antifa.
But look no further, my friends, than the work of Glenn Beck and his excellent media organization, Blaze Media. They recently took the time to take a deeper dive into the various tentacles of Antifa that exist out there in the real world, and here's what they found. Play the first Glenn Beck clip, please.
But they have no apparent leader or organization. Who's planning that? Universities like CUNY in New York, they have entire courses on global Antifa. It's a 14-week course of far-left revolutionary activism at a college located smack dab in the financial epicenter of the world. But it has no recognized leader, no organization. That's bullcrap, and everyone knows it. I'm going to show you this was just off the cuff, okay? This is how hard it really is, okay? So let's just speculate here for a minute. Let's call it a starting point for people at the FBI or Justice Department as they begin investigating leads. For far too long, the people potentially supporting Antifa have remained in the shadows. That's what Trump is going to end. Is Antifa more than just a decentralized and leaderless organization? Well, I've split Antifa up into three different categories: street groups and soldiers, that one, support groups, and funding sources. But let me start right at the top with the street groups and soldiers, because this is where the politicians, the media, and the think tanks say, you know, that's the investigation. You just can investigate these guys. Nothing else. Don't look here. But the groups are all over the news, going back to around 2016. Groups like Rose City Antifa Portland, Elm Fork John Brown Gun Club, Eugene Antifa Oregon, Atlanta, Pittsburgh Antifa, Refuse Fascism, Jane's Revenge. Now, you've seen the carnage of these groups all over. We continue to see it every day in places like Chicago and Portland, but this is where we're supposed to stop looking.
Yeah. So he was not speaking in an echo chamber when he did that special via Blaze Media. In fact, his reporting quickly attracted the attention of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who contacted him and advised him that several agents from the FBI would be coming to his home to further discuss what his special reporting had revealed. Play that clip.
It's just leaderless and decentralized.
We thought, no, it's really not. So we dove in headfirst, and we analyzed the Antifa network, and we went from the street thugs to the support groups, eventually to the funding. Okay. To say the FBI was interested in this might be an understatement. Let's just say the FBI is turning over every single stone. It is so clear to me that they are exploring all angles of this, and they are talking to anyone and everyone that can give them any kind of information. How do I know? Saturday, I get a phone call. The director would like to send over some agents to speak to you, Glenn. And I'm like, the direct FBI agents? Yes, you said some things that they need to talk to you about. And I'm like, well, good things are bad. You know, they'll be over. So they sat in my living room. Three agents sat in my living room on Saturday afternoon for almost 2 hours.
Wow. So that just tells you that, it is very apparent to the FBI and law enforcement across the country that the Antifa movement is very well coordinated and, of course, also very well funded. Today, for example, there is expected to be a huge anti-Trump, anti-MAGA, let's call it a rally. It may devolve into something worse in Washington and other places under the moniker of No Kings. This, of course, to infer that Trump is some kind of a dictator or a monarch, when in fact he is just doing what 78 million people voted to see him do. But they call it the No Kings. And, of course, this is an offshoot of the coordination of the Antifa movement. And how do they continue to carry these things out? With money, substantial funding. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas thinks we ought to put an end to the money pipelines. Play that clip.
The Democrats today are a party of radical interest groups. Now, I will say one of the most important things President Trump has done recently is he has pledged that he's going to go after Antifa. And what I've been urging is follow the money, cut off the money. And you look at this No Kings rally, and there's considerable evidence that George Soros and his network is behind funding these rallies, which may well be riots all across the country. And Soros is writing the check. And so I've introduced legislation called the Stop Funders Act that would add rioting to the list of predicate offenses for RICO. Why is that? Because it would let the Department of Justice use RICO racketeering to prosecute the money that is funding the anti-Semitic protests on campuses, the pro-open border protest in L.A. and other cities, and these No King protests. Anyone that is supporting rioting and violence, it lets you go after the money. And I'll tell you, there are more than 200 left-wing groups behind this. These No Kings rallies this weekend. They deliberately are blind to what each of the others are doing. That's part of how they avoid accountability. RICO is designed for precisely that sort of criminal enterprise. And so I believe the Senate, we ought to take up and vote on and pass our Stop Funders legislation. And I've urged both Pam Bondi at DOJ and Cash Patel at FBI, follow the money and prosecute those who are writing checks funding acts of violence, political violence or otherwise, across the country.
And boy, does he hit that one right on the head. And by the way, you may have also noticed that at least so far, we don't see very much activity, Antifa activity in small towns and rural areas. We see it in the cities. And in fact, writing for the Wall Street Journal in the past week, Jeffrey Anderson, who is the head of an organization called the American Main Street Initiative, makes this very important observation about crime. Violent crime has not risen in suburban or rural areas over the past roughly 5 years, but is up 61% in urban areas. So he concludes that Donald Trump is right, that American cities aren't nearly as safe as they were before systemic racism became a familiar accusation and defund the police became a rallying cry. And behind all of that are these Antifa factions, as we well know. I wanted to remind you that coming up later in the program, we will be talking to Emily Stack, the chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans. Some of her fellow young Republicans in states outside of North Carolina made some headlines this week, and not good headlines, owed to the reporting by the Politico organization, Politico.com. She's going to talk about some of these vulgar texts that were leaked involving young Republicans and how they are not at all a reflection of the young Republicans that that are in her orbit. Also, we're going to be talking to Benjamin Rollins, who is launching a Turning Point USA chapter here locally on Airport Road at Sand Hills Community College. That organization, of course, founded by Charlie Kirk, who was assassinated on September 10th, and who this past week was posthumously awarded the Medal of Freedom, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, by President Trump. Standing in for Charlie was, of course, his talented and grieving widow, Erica Kirk, in a ceremony at the White House. It was a day, really, of celebration of his life, although many are still in mourning. It also occurred on the date of his 32nd birthday. It was also a day of memories of both the date on which he left this world, and also anticipation of the awarding of this medal. Let's start by hearing the clip from Vice President J.D. Vance.
I'll tell you a little backstory about just sort of this dignified transfer where Usha and I go out and pick up Charlie's body, pick up Erica, pick up some of you guys, and then take him back to Arizona. I mean, the background on that was I was sitting at the White House with then communications director. He has since, you know, taken a job in the private sector, making a lot of money, I'm sure. Taylor Budowich, who was another dear friend of Charlie's. And, you know, Mikey was actually communicating with Taylor directly. And so, you know, it's a little gruesome, but right after Charlie gets shot, Mikey's like, you know, we're at the hospital. Charlie's got a pulse. I'm sure you guys were getting the same messages.
I was talking with Taylor a little bit.
This sort of point of like optimism where it's like, oh my God, because you see the video, you think there's no way Charlie's going to make it, but you say, oh, you know, could this be a miraculous thing? And then, of course, Mikey was the one who had to make the call to Taylor and to me. I was actually in Stephen Miller's office with Taylor, and Mikey said, you know, Charlie didn't make it. The doctors just called it. And that was obviously an incredibly hard moment. But then I was sitting with Taylor and I was like, well, you know, what do we do now? And Taylor actually had the idea of we should go out there. And I was like, that's an incredible idea. Like, I'd love to go out there, see Erica. But you also wonder, like, you know, the Vice President of the United States, the Secret Service detail, the media, does it become too much of a spectacle? So I was like, reach out to Erica and like, let her know. I'm not pushing, but if she wants me to come out there, we'd love to be out there and be supportive. And so he did that, and she, of course, was receptive. And then I actually had the idea. I texted my chief of staff. I was like, well, wait a second. If we're going to be out there, you know, moving a dead body from one place to another is not necessarily like easy logistically. We have a big airplane, and if we're going to fly from Utah to Phoenix anyway, we should offer. And he was like, yeah, I'll offer. I'll never forget my chief of staff saying, I doubt they'll accept. I'm sure they already have another plan, but we can offer. And then, of course, you know, you guys accepted, and that led to that day, which, despite the grieving, was very special to be able to be part of that grieving process with the family and with all you guys.
And if you had any doubt as to the love and respect and adoration towards Charlie Kirk by Republicans across the spectrum, we saw that it starts at the very top this past week with the President of the United States, who flies to Israel to sign a peace agreement between Israel and Hamas, then to Egypt for a summit with world leaders, then back overnight in order to be at the White House for the awarding of the Medal of Freedom to Charlie Kirk's widow. It was an incredible logistical flurry, and in the middle of it was White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
Yeah, well, it was all of our first instinct as well when we knew that the deal was going to be signed. And Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff called the president from the Middle East and said, sir, now it's now or never, right? You got to get out here. We need to sign this deal. We need to get these hostages out. We need this momentum. And it's crucially important, literally, for peace in the Middle East. And all of us here thought, oh, my gosh, we have the ceremony for Charlie on Tuesday. I hope we don't have to delay it. And the president said it was a non-negotiable for him. And I think that really speaks to how much he loved and respected Charlie. There are very few people in this world that the president would really cut a trip short, because there was much more we could have done. I mean, we left the White House at 5 p.m. on Sunday evening. We flew all the way to the Middle East. We landed in Israel like 9 a.m. local time, so it was the middle of the night, Eastern time. We went to Israel. The president gave that amazing speech in Jerusalem, and he met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, met with hostage families. We get back on the plane, fly an hour to Egypt, go to Egypt, and meet with world leaders from all over the planet and sign the Arab peace agreement, and really began phase two of this peace process. And then we got right back on the plane and came home. And so we were gone for, I think it was 36 total hours. When I got home at 3:30 in the morning, my husband said, I can't believe you just went all the way to Africa and back in like one day. But we did it for Charlie, and I'm so glad we did. And I know the president is glad, because yesterday was such a beautiful ceremony. And the way that the sun broke through the clouds and just kind of was over the Rose Garden, it was so peaceful, so beautiful. And so we're so glad we were able to make it back.
We are joined now by Emily Stack, who is the chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, Steve.
Thank you for joining us. Let's get right to the chase here. There was a bit of a nuclear device dropped on the news cycle in the past week by Politico, which is a digital news organization that covers all things politics and culture. And what they reported was that they had been leaked a massive trove of back and forth chat conversations among young Republicans in four states who are all part of their state young Republican organizations, Arizona, Kansas, New York, and Vermont. These chats reflect all kinds of vulgar and sexist and racist comments. We don't know. We have no way of knowing which among them are literal and which among them may have been used sarcastically. Of course, the left doesn't understand sarcasm, but that's, I won't get off on that tangent too much. But Politico, of course, is continuing to throw gasoline on this dumpster fire that they started. Their latest dispatch, and I'll just read this verbatim from a post today at politico.com. As the leaked Young Republicans chat reveals, the hateful, troll-like way in which these people communicate, these people, has also found its way into the mainstream GOP. I would pause to say that is a strange conclusion to draw. They continue, it's a trend that could become more visible as a generation of chronically online young people on the right age into higher positions of power and are embraced by the party. Now, Emily, let me ask you, you've been affiliated with the Young Republicans for a number of years. You attended the National Federation Convention in Nashville earlier this year. How many young Republicans in your sphere, people that you interact with both in North Carolina and in places around the country, how many of them would you classify as racist, sexist, vulgar, bigots, generally speaking?
None of the ones that we associate with, Steve. Actually, the people in that chat were very much not people we voted for at National, because the chat came up specifically as a, what's the word for it? They were a slate, for lack of better words, basically running against the current leadership.
Sort of a breakaway group, huh?
Right, sort of a breakaway group. And this is actually the second time we've seen them run. And the time before, about 2 years ago in Dallas, we had a delegation out there, and they each time our delegation has voted against these specific individuals. But this is the first time we're getting to like see the, I guess, the extent with which they are like this. I mean, we all kind of knew they were not great people to begin with.
Well, I would love to see some secret chat exchanges between young Democrats. I can only imagine what topics they might delve into. But, you know, maybe someday we'll get to see those. But this is obviously a really bad look. This plays into all of the things that the left wants the public to believe about the conservative movement, the MAGA movement, whatever you want to call it. But I would go way out on a limb and say that the vast, vast majority of young Republicans in this country are much more in alignment with the Charlie Kirk Turning Point USA faith before politics view of the world than any of these sort of delusional young people who are reflected in these chats. And in fact, both the North Carolina Federation and the National Federation have been very quick to denounce them. And what else is going to happen to them, do you suppose?
Well, I know that not only have they denounced them, but they've called for them to resign in their states. So obviously, if they're not resigning, they're going to, I assume, I don't know the procedure and process for which it is takes to remove a state chair. I have not seen it before. It hasn't happened during my time as chair, but I assume there's a process for removal to get rid of them. But there's a lot of pressure from everywhere for these people to resign, and quite a few have lost their jobs, which I want to kind of point out for a minute that it kind of shows the extent with these chats. Something they haven't highlighted as much is that these people actually have done the blackmailing and what's the other word? Gotten people out of their jobs and whatnot before. They have bragged about those sort of things in the chat as well. It's my understanding, and so it's not one of those situations where it's like, oh, you know, we've doxed someone and they've gotten, you know, lost their jobs. Well, these people have actually done it to other people and all over young Republican issues. They've actually caused, I think they said one issue was that they released someone's explicit photo or something of like, you know, someone, you know, a racy photo of some sort. And yeah, that's considered revenge porn. And they have done that. And so it's kind of like, all right, we're not dealing with people that just say things. These people are also willing to do things.
And of course, if you look more closely at the Politico reporting on this story, they talk about how the chats offer an unfiltered look at how a new generation of GOP activists talk when they think no one is listening. I would say that characterizing these young people from four states, not 54 or 44 states. Are there 54 states? No, I guess there aren't. Not yet. We're working on Canada and a few others. But saying that these are the face of a new generation of GOP activists, is that your experience in interacting with your generation of young Republicans?
No, I'd say not, because a lot of the people that they were mentioning and targeting in the chat are people that are a variety of walks of life and good people that just really want to have a better, they want to have a better Republican Party. They want to have a better country and they want a better future. And a lot of them have kids, so they want better futures for their kids. You know, not this.
Precisely. Well, I can only imagine that, people like yourself, in positions on these state federations are having a conversation very similar to what we're having here right now, which is who are these people? How do we eradicate them from the young Republican orbit? And then what should we do next to reassure our own membership and, for that matter, Republicans of all generations that these people are outliers. There may have even been some alcohol involved in this. It occurs to me. What can you do? Do you think to repair to the damage to the extent that this damage is long term? What can be done to fix it?
Well, I would say honestly, so long as we keep, you know, policing ourselves, I think it is like about policing ourselves, right? We have to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And we have to put in the work, too. For instance, like Democrats should be, you know, outraged about Jay Jones and calling for him to drop out of the race in Virginia. And, you know, just like we police our own, we should tell them to police their own, because we've got to put in the work. And another thing to note, like that means going out and actually putting in the work. Like we were door knocking last weekend for Winston Sears. So a lot of the people that are willing to put in the work for these good candidates, you'll see that, and that's what helps push forward better people and better candidates and helping facilitate that sort of, I guess, culture or environment within our party.
And you referenced Winsom Sears. She's running for governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. She is a Jamaican-born woman, a really charismatic and dynamic candidate with, I think, a very bright future. And yet, you've got Barack Obama coming out to support her opponent in that race. And you mentioned Jay Johnson running for attorney general. Okay, here's a guy running for attorney general who has unapologetically in the past referenced wanting to shoot his political adversaries with a gun in the head, like bang, bang, you're dead. This guy is running to be the premier law enforcer of his state, and yet others in the Virginia Democrat Party have A, not demanded that he drop out of the race, and B, have not even condemned his behavior. So I ask you, is this not more serious in terms of what it says about the Democrat Party, at least in Virginia, than any of these potentially drunken chats by young Republicans?
I don't know. So actually, a few of the messages were rather violent towards our own members. And that's even, I don't know, that's pretty concerning as well. So I just want to say that both of those should not be okay, period.
Right. Yeah, no, of course not. And this whole idea that, those of us who embrace the Second Amendment or those of us who embrace freedom of speech, that somehow we conflate that with excusing gun violence or excusing speech that is dangerous or inflammatory. That's obviously an absurd premise and always has been. So I understand that do the young Republicans meet every year at a national convention?
It's actually every other year we have a national convention. So we just had this one this past summer, so we won't have another national convention until the year after next.
Okay, so that'll be 27, and by then the, is that right?
Correct.
And then by then the midterm elections will have happened, and this will all be a, this will probably all be a distant memory, and these people will be long forgotten, let us hope. Emily Stack, we thank you very much for joining us here this morning on everybody's favorite Saturday morning show here on WEEB. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate it.
Joining us in the studio, Benjamin Rollins. Benjamin, in my estimation, is doing something right now that is worthy of our admiration. He, along with several others, are in the process of launching a Turning Point USA chapter at Sandhills Community College, which heretofore has not had one. And in fact, believe it or not, across Moore County, there, to my knowledge, are no Turning Point chapters in any of our public schools. There is one that was launched by some homeschooled teenagers, which we may have them in as well in the future to talk about what they're doing. But we're joined by Benjamin Rollins. Thank you for coming in, Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
So, of course, we know, unfortunately, in the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's assassination, that part of what he gave his life for, I guess, was the sudden interest in Turning Point USA and its mission to enlighten high school and college kids on how they can both articulate their faith and also stand their ground in the arena of ideology and political discourse. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, your background. I believe you, we talked about offline that you had been a musician for a while. Maybe you still consider yourself a musician. Tell us how you sort of made that that turn from thinking that the left-wing ideology was the norm to having the epiphany that it didn't align with what you actually believe.
When I played music, I ended up being in a lot of leftist circles, left-leaning friends and people that I associated with. And oftentimes their ideology, things they would talk about, I would find at least in my head disagreeing with or finding fault with whatever they were saying. And during the pandemic, I moved down to Lorenberg. I had been living in Durham, which was a pretty liberal city. So in Lorenberg, I was away from all of that, and I started to have some room to think for myself and to be comfortable with those ideas. Another thing that I would do is I had heard about Candace Owens, and I'd heard some people talking about how they didn't like her ideas. They thought she was wrong. So I said, well, I'll watch some of her videos. I'll try to disprove some of her ideas, and found myself agreeing with pretty much everything that she had to say at the time. This was 4 or 5 years ago. And that led to also watching Charlie Kirk videos. And I had the same intention. I'll watch these videos. I'll see what I can, you know, tear apart his arguments. And again, agreed with everything that he had to say. And this informed my faith more than anything, because that was mostly what he was talking about. And I noticed that it was drawing me closer to God in my faith.
And what motivated you to decide that you're going to be the guy who launches this Turning Point USA chapter? What was the catalyst for that?
Well, I intended to do it last year when I first started taking classes at Sandhills Community College. I looked to see if there was a Turning Point chapter, and there wasn't. And it was on my mind. I said, maybe I should start one. And then, you know, one thing after another, and time just slips away. So it never happened. And then a few weeks ago, when Charlie was assassinated, I thought about it again. And I felt somewhat guilty because I hadn't already started one. So I got online. I went on the Turning Point USA website and registered to receive information from them. And then it was a few days later that I got a text message from the area representative for Turning Point USA. And it was myself and one other person that has been working with me that were in the text thread that first day. And they said, would you be interested in starting a chapter? And we both were immediately said yes to that. So then we got together that same day just to talk about it and flesh it out and everything. So that was about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
And then the really important next step was to find a member of the Sandhills faculty that would be willing to be your sponsor and your advisor. And tell us how that process played out.
So we had a meeting. We talked about different methods in which we could find an advisor. We developed a strategy, and we started emailing different faculty and different departments we thought might be favorable to being our advisor. And initially, we had a few faculty members that responded positively and told us in their first email, you know, we'll do anything to help. And then after that, they kind of backed out or went cold on us.
Radio silent,
yes,
as they say.
So eventually, we had one of the people that's working with us went and talked to one of his professors and asked, you know, had a face-to-face conversation with him and seemed agreeable. So then he passed his contact information along to me. I had a phone conversation with him for about half an hour, and he said everything sounded good. So we're just waiting for him to complete the advisor form and all of our steps leading up to what we need to have done to become officially recognized by the school will be complete.
And then what is the progression there in terms of the approval process? What, assuming that, you know, he submits the application, then what happens next?
So we've submitted our registration application. We've submitted the club constitution, which we had to write. So he'll submit the advisor form, and then the student life department will review everything and make sure everything looks okay. And they'll send that to student government, who will then vote to sanction our chapter into being officially recognized by the school. And there we'll have to go to the student government meeting and answer questions they might have about our chapter.
So when do you think we can expect to see the Turning Point USA Sandhills Community College chapter on the college website or in other listings of its clubs and activities?
I would like, my goal would be to have by the end of this fall semester to be recognized and to be adding official members to the club, planning events and having meetings.
You mentioned to me in our previous conversation that you now have six people who have sort of come forward and said, we want to be a part of this on the campus. What other feedback are you getting? How are you feeling about the response to this going forward?
I personally believe this has the potential to be the largest student organization on the campus at Sandhills Community College. So far, we haven't advertised. This is all word of mouth. We've had a few opportunities to raise some awareness to what we're doing, but I've told my team so far, let's get through this process to be officially sanctioned by the school, and then we can begin to market and add members on a broader spectrum. But so far, I believe we've had about 100 students that have expressed interest in being a part of this Turning Point USA club.
And I would imagine, given the number of existing chapters, you know, and it's really incredible. It's almost staggering when you think about it, that in the space of around 12 years, you know, Charlie Kirk took the germ of an idea that I can go into the college campuses and I can connect with these young people. He took that premise and has turned it into a really a very well-oiled machine, which has, you know, chapters from coast to coast, and now we're expanding into high schools. And I mean, it's really an incredible story. And it, of course, I think we're seeing in his widow, Erica, a person who is strong and bold and has no intention of backing down from the mission. And I think that, of course, is very encouraging because she had kept a rather low profile until after Charlie was assassinated. We're talking to Benjamin Rollins about the Turning Point USA chapter, which is on its way to becoming a reality off of Airport Road at Sandhills Community College. Benjamin, you said that you all had a presence at an event called Unity Fest recently, which I think some of our listeners are probably familiar with. It's been, I want to say it's been around for a number of years now, annually. What kind of visibility did you have there, and what was the reaction to your presence?
So we were able to set up a tent with a table, and we had help from the Turning Point Faith Chapter of Moore County as far as resources go. We had some brochures and flyers and buttons and things like that we were able to pass out. If I had to estimate, I would say there were a couple thousand people that came out throughout the day for the whole festival on Saturday, which was the day we were set up. And we talked to, if I had to guess, and we didn't count, we probably should have, but I would estimate 400 or 500 people that came by just to talk to us, to ask how they could get involved, to ask what we had been up to and everything like that. We were able to get in front of the crowd they gave me a couple minutes to just kind of pitch the chapter and everything. So it was a really good experience for us.
And I don't know how others feel, but my feeling since September 10th, when Charlie left this world, is that although it was a very traumatizing thing to hear about, that this young man was gone, I feel like he has emboldened those of us on the right and those of us who do not take for granted our freedom as Americans, and those of us who believe we have an obligation to stand in the breach and protect our religious and our freedom as citizens in this country going forward. I can only tell you that I felt on September 10th very similar to the way I felt 24 years earlier on September 11th, 2001, a sense of emptiness. Like I didn't know how to feel. I was numb about it. You know, it was so beyond comprehension. Both seeing those towers collapsing on 9/11. I imagine you were probably a teenager.
Yes.
On 9/11. And then literally, as a regular consumer of the streaming network on which Charlie's show aired, Real America's Voice, on the day of his death, I was watching. And, of course, it was well known that he was in Utah launching this campus tour. This was the first stop. And so his show that day was preempted by some previously taped interviews that he had done with other guests. And I knew that because I knew what was going on. And then at 2:00 Eastern time, a show comes on called Human Events Daily, which is hosted by a young retired naval intelligence officer named Jack Posobiec, who is very close to Charlie Kirk and in the same, you know, moved in the same circles that Charlie did in terms of having access to the White House and Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump and all those people. They were moving in the same sort of rarefied air, you might say. And so Jack's show is not on now. It's a little after 2 p.m. And the show is proceeding, and I believe that Charlie was shot about 23 or 24 minutes after the top of the hour on September 10th. And you could visibly, in the demeanor of Jack Posobiec, sense that something had gone terribly wrong at this rally. In the moment, my feeling was there must have been an incident. There must have been some hecklers or some protesters or something like that. Nothing to the extent of gun violence. But as his show proceeded, you could see, and Jack was not giving away what he probably already knew. And he went from, I sensed that he at first was shocked, and then he started getting kind of ticked off as he learned what was going on. What did you feel like on that day when you'd learned that Charlie Kirk had been assassinated in Utah?
When I learned that Charlie had been assassinated, I was absolutely devastated. I hadn't been that sad and empty feeling. It almost was surreal. It was hard to believe. I'd been working that day. I'd been in and out. I'd been on the phone with a friend for about an hour. So I remember walking into my dad's house, and he said, "Hey, just so you know, Charlie Kirk has been shot." And I remember my heart sank then. And then it was about an hour later that he came to me and he said, "Hey, they just announced that Charlie passed away." And it was probably a good 3 weeks where I couldn't even talk about it. Every time at church or at school or with friends, when it would come up, and I would try to form a sentence about how I felt or what happened or anything to do with Charlie, I would get so choked up that I'd have to take a moment and just breathe. You know, I think a lot of people have made the statement, I've never shed so many tears for somebody I didn't actually know. And I think it's because Charlie represented a lot of us on that stage. He's a one-of-a-kind person that was the voice for so many of us, for millions of people. And I just, the heaviness of it all is still with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people who are even older than I am, which I know it's hard to comprehend, will tell you they had a similar feeling when JFK was assassinated in 1963, or RFK in 68, Martin Luther King also in 68. It is a life-changing experience, even for, again, as you said, you mourn for someone you can't really say that you personally know. Tell us, Benjamin, how we can follow you on social media going forward. I'm sure people would like to be able to do that.
So right now, our main social media page is on Instagram. That seems to be the most popular way to post events and pictures from our past events. And you can just search for TPUSA at Sandhills Community College and find us there.
We'll be sure to do that. Again, this has been Benjamin Rollins joining us today. He's launching Turning Point USA here locally at the Sandhills Community College. And to wrap up our conversation, Benjamin, I just wanted to leave everyone with the words of Charlie Kirk. And here's what he said. Here was his worldview. "What we take for granted as right and wrong is a Christian inheritance that has been passed down through many years. If we're serious about saving this country, we need to get back to the source of where that inheritance came from, the Word of God, and our true citizenship, which is in heaven." Thanks again, Benjamin.
Thank you.
Let me once again thank our guests, Emily Stack and Benjamin Rollins, for their insights this morning. And we thank all of you for making us part of your Saturday mornings each and every week. I'm Steve Woodward, awaiting the return of World Explorer and my talented co-host, David Hensley, who we expect to see back right here when we do what we do, exposing deception, corruption, and rhino impostures, and taking aim.